This is most, if not all, of the material that I think I will be distributing, although I probably will be, I could be passing out more later. This is all I have to begin with, and we'll be working through various items in this handbook the whole semester long. It is three hole punched so that if you are in the mind to take notes, you can put this in a notebook and you can put your own notes in between it. If you're not in a mind to do that, then you can certainly just keep the handbook stapled together. I will not be handing out daily or class notes from my talk. My experience is that while that might help get you through the class, it's not necessarily beneficial to most people to have after the thing is over. So if you want more information or you want more written down that I give you, then you can ask for it, but I don't want to, you know, we'll do our part for Greenpeace here, you know, and we'll save some trees. I'm starting this course at a particular moment chronologically in terms of several things that I have in mind. One is that I want to continue to strengthen your general awareness of church history, not just in the biblical age, but through the entirety of the 2,000 years that we have had witness of Christ on earth, both in its glory and in its warts and its despising. The church has embarrassed herself much more than she has brought glory to Christ. I think we're all aware of that in many different ways. But the thing that I really want more than anything else is for you to grow in your awareness of not just what the church has done in the world, but what Christ is doing in the world. That goes along, of course, in a very parallel fashion to our study of the book of Acts on Lord's Day mornings. We are going to be working through that, so you'll notice some parallels with this particular course as we do that. But we're moving along a much faster pace here than we are in our sermons. I also want to then follow this immediately with a study of the ancient church beginning in January. So we'll be passing right from the period of the apostolic age, in other words, a survey of what's going on in the book of Acts primarily, into the church and its growth after we leave the inspired period, where we have definite, faithful, trustworthy, historical, divinely given historical record in the book of Acts. We move then to historians of the ancient church up until the Nicene Creed era of about 325. And then after that, I want my vision or goal is to proceed right on into the church in the post-Nicene Creed era, Nicene Council, to study in the 4th through the 6th century, because that will bring us to our most important post-apostolic theologian, Augustine. And I want to spend some time talking about him. You'll notice this also parallels with the theme of this Reformation month that I want to take annually in October. Reformation month. I still stumble over the title of this. I haven't got a good handle on it. But it basically is the idea that the church is constantly being called by God to return to the Scriptures, to examine her own traditions, her own practice, the influence of culture upon Christianity. Sometimes we're very sensitive and we're very attentive to the opposite, Christianity's influence on culture, but all too often culture influences and corrupts Christianity. And therefore, the church is constantly being called back to the Scriptures, constantly being called to reform herself. And that's not just a 16th century phenomenon, but it's something that happens again and again and again, whenever the faithful Church of Christ rises up and says, back to the Word of God, to the prophets, to the law, to the Word of God, as the Old Testament prophets used to say. So I want to do that every year with the idea of highlighting some particular watershed period of church history that we might examine. This year it's the ancient church, which is, you know, very part and parcel with everything else we're studying. But in later years, I want to build up to a rather climactic event among Calvinists. Some of you guys are going to roll your eyes at this, but that's okay. In 2009, the broad Reformed and Presbyterian community will be celebrating the 500th birthday and anniversary of Calvin's birthday. And to that extent, there's going to be lots of pomp and ceremony. And what I mean by that are tours and websites and books and conferences and all kinds of stuff. And so generally speaking, I'm also on a track to accelerate as we build up towards 2009 so that we just have a general flow of study that brings us up to the birthday of Calvin. All right, well, having gone through all that, let's take a quick look at the handbook for the course that runs now from today through the end of December, with the exception of the last Sunday being December 30th. We will not be meeting on that day. The outline is the first thing that I have before you, and I divide this up categorically. I want to look at some background material first, and that includes the world stage upon which the gospel was presented. I'm only going to spend 1 week on the subject and character and life of Christ. I'm going to do that with apologies to the most important figure in the world, but still, in terms of the entire scope of the course, I'm going to presume that you understand that aspect. And then third, we move to the apostolic age itself, the foundational, the epical character, the racial character, the enduring character of the apostolic church. And in this we'll be studying James and then Peter and then Paul, and then closing with John, and look at what the early church was looking for in terms of the end of the age. There is one class that I am still unclear about whether I'll be here. That's December the 7th. October the 7th. I don't know if the jury is still out as to whether I'll be here for that. I also want to take a week sometime, although I'm not sure how to fit it in yet, to do a survey of the letters of Paul. That may seem outrageous too, that I don't have time for that. But the letters of Paul play a significant role, obviously, in the building of the church. But it's not like we're unfamiliar with that as well. And so I'll be just surveying their influence as we go along. There are several articles that follow that, written by various people, on the perspective that you should have as you look and read history. One's called On History, another Time and Progress, the Hebraic Mind. I'd like you to just read those on your own so that you get an idea of the context and the background and the way people think and how thinking has developed even. One of the most remarkable things about the influence of the Judeo age, the influence of the writings of Moses, the law of God, the book of Genesis, was to contribute to a linear understanding of history, that there is indeed a beginning, that there is indeed an end, and there is indeed a flow of progression from one end to the other. We just that's a no-brainer to us. History is linear. We're used to that, but even in Greece, that was a radical thought. It was not useful in terms of the way people used to think. So we're going to see some change there. There's a Greek chronology, other comparative kinds of things. There's a map. There's a few maps in there, things that you'll get into. Just make yourself familiar with that. Would be good. And from time to time, we will be referring to those things. What I want to do then as we begin the course is take the first couple of weeks on setting the stage in terms of background. Then I want to take a couple of weeks setting the stage in terms of the nations that play the most influence in the apostolic age to the church. So we'll work on the background first. And the background is often referred to by Christians or in the church, generally speaking, as the intertestamental period. More popularly, it's known as the 400 silent years. And what we're talking about, of course, is the fact that the Old Testament ends with the book of Malachi, the period of time in which Zechariah and Malachi were writing was the return of the exile, you remember, and the reestablishment, the resetting up of the city of Jerusalem, the rebuilding of the temple, their struggle to stay alive in the midst of the Samaritan hassle that was coming from the north. There is where it closes. You even think of the book of Malachi, you know, where it's where he is railing against his fellow Jews about the hypocrisy of their worship. And already, you know, they're falling back into their pragmatic kind of practices, you know. And his great scolding is, try, you know, this is how you treat God. Try doing that to your governor. Which means, you know, he's the whole aspect of that is that this is the world, this is the limited world that we leave the Jews in at the Old Testament. Is they're, you know, they're just focusing on their thing in regards to resetting and establishing their city and what's left of their people and their population, and there the inspired word closes, and we don't hear anything for 400 so years until indeed Matthew picks it up in writing the Gospel of Matthew. He says that Mary and Joseph show up on a donkey, and all of a sudden everything starts over again. And yet the world is so very, very different. Now it's Rome that rules the world, and everything has a much more Western slant to it than it did before. But it was ancient Near East. They had left Persia to the east, and the world was Persian, and there was an Eastern kind of flavor that is to us as Christians still remarkably very different. And yet when we start the New Testament, it's very Western in its flavor. It's very, you know, Rome, and we're very, of course, familiar with what's going on. It's a very, very different kind of stage that's set, and that difference in the scenario, that difference in the context, has been has served to be what I think a discouragement for many Christians to bother to study the Old Testament at all. They see the difference, you know. They see, well, the Old Testament had to do with the Jews, and it was Eastern, and it was very confusing, and Rome was Western, and the New Testament just seems much more like what we're used to, and it's much more familiar, and it serves to keep the two testaments apart for lots of us as Christians. We're not only ignorant of what was going on, as vital and as critical as what was going on during that period of time, but it's almost used as an excuse to say, well, we don't need to bother studying the Old Testament because this is where it's really important. You know, the New Testament is the part that's really, really critical. But in truth, God's been working for thousands of years to set the stage for the coming of His own Son. He has been working providentially to raise and defeat kingdom after kingdom after kingdom with its own influence and its own set of circumstances and its own contribution to God's overall redemptive plan to form and to fashion the world and the Jewish people as he would see fit. And it's very important and very vital for us to see exactly what's going on in this silent period of time, so that we have more appreciation for the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and why it is, for instance, that things are the way they are. We leave the Old Testament with heroes like Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel, you know, who are feisty guys, inspiring. Ezra, you know, stands up and he opens the book of the law to be read, and the people stand at the reading of the Word of God, and they remain standing as He teaches them for hour after hour after hour, because they are so eager to hear, and there is such boldness and courage. You know, Nehemiah says, "You build the walls with a trowel in one hand and a spear in the other, and we're gonna, you know, we close that period. We open up in Gospel, and the Jews are henpecked by Rome. There aren't any courageous leaders. There's the Pharisees who are nitpickers and troublemakers. And what is with the change? So it's very important for us to see the background and to understand this intertestamental period and the influence that it makes in its contribution. Generally speaking, let me just do it this way. Oh, I want to. I got to say by way of caveat, I am not a. You need to know this. I am not a trained historian in any way, shape, or form. I did not major in history. I'm not schooled to be a teacher of history. I love to share with you what I myself have discovered and learned. It's one of the benefits of being a pastor. The idea that you get paid to do this is just right up my alley. I just love it. But still, if I could live my life over again, I would have been a history major, because I've become so fascinated with it. But I do not profess to have, a PhD's grasp on the details. And there will be times when, if you know anything about what I'm teaching, you might have differences of opinion with regard to what I'm emphasizing historically, and that's okay. I'm a self-admitted broad-brush historian. You please feel free to talk to me about things that you think I have wrong. And I'll be glad to go back and amend my thoughts. There are basically two things that are going on during the intertestamental period that contribute to the drastic changes that we see between the closing of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. The first of those changes, of course, is that the world is exploding and expanding. Culture in every way we think of that term is literally taking off. Sometimes we study the history of Greece, the developments in the arts and the sciences. You watch the Discovery Channel and you're amazed at how much their medical doctors knew that has then since been forgotten, only to be rediscovered 20 centuries later. The developments in architecture, we're somehow out there we have heard of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, and we know that they were philosophers, and we know that they wrote boring books, and we know, they're out there somewhere, but where they fit in has never registered with us. But that all of that is what's going on during this intertestamental period. Culture in the real sense is just simply exploding. Might makes right is the rule of thumb for the earlier nations. And arts and sciences, music, culture, all those things were low key. They were not important. It was more the military campaigns, the glory of the king's palace, and the size of his harem was equivalent to his riches and his wealth. But now there is a great explosion in this period of time of what we call and what we appreciate today as culture in every sense of the term. The second thing that's going on is that there is this resettling of the Jews back in Jerusalem after the dismissal of the exile. And they are now burned in their experience. They were the glorious center of the universe, the city of Jerusalem, the temple of the Lord. This can never happen to us. We are God's people, and it happened. First there was a civil war that split them apart, and then there was the carrying off in exile, and now only a smattering of them have come back. And they came back very severely affected by that. They are also much more immediately aware of the fact that God is not speaking, that the prophets do not follow. Ezra, was a great teacher, but he was not followed by Isaiah or another Jeremiah or somebody else that was teaching with a divine inspiration. The vacuum of leadership became very apparent, especially the vacuum of divine leadership. The exile had done a great deal to disturb the descendancy record of the priesthood. It was like, somebody was telling me they were, Jason Van Bemmel was telling me he was trying to find his baptismal records of his childhood church, and turned out they had a fire and those records were destroyed. He doesn't have a record of his infant baptism. The linear descendancy of the priesthood was very critical to the promise, to the understanding of the promise of God, and to who it was that would take. That's all been eradicated. It's all been destroyed. And they only have word of mouth, and they only have tradition. And so they come back very confused. And as a result of that, the Jews became very concerned about preserving what was left. And so on the one hand, you've got the explosion of the world. And on the other hand, you have these Jews who are huddled together, and they are trying their best not to be swallowed up again. And both of these dynamics are in play. Both of them, the Jewish people, have a contribution to. These two trends are right here. God has stopped speaking through his prophets. He's preparing his people for his preparation for the coming of the Messiah is complete. He's given his Old Testament word. He's led them through all of this. There has been, we know from our perspective that God has set the stage and continuing to set the stage for the coming of his Son. But his silence does not mean that he is not acting, that he is not in the midst of moving these nations around. And we're oftentimes unaware of what's going on. But they're important because of those things. I'm way behind here, see. And those are the two trends. The world is quickly changing, and the Jews in Judah, or now called Judea, are becoming very entrenched. So we start with where the Old Testament leaves off, and that is the power of the Persian Empire. We go to the first of those two points, the explosion and the change that's going on in the world scene. When we left, Cyrus was dismissing not only the Jews, but also several other captive nations that he had inherited from the previous empire of Babylon. Now, here is a map of the Persian Empire, okay? Don't worry too much about the details. Let me just try to see if this works. It doesn't. Okay. Over here is Persia proper, and up here is on the Euphrates River is where Babylon is, and Babylonia was the huge empire at the time of the fall of Judah, the burning of the temple, the destruction, the carrying off of the exiles of Daniel and Ezekiel and others. And Babylonia's empire, capital was Babylon. A magnificent city, glorious in every possible detail. It was one of those cities that the king of Persia, when he came to attack it, did not want to destroy it as you might do to any other nation's enemy nation's capital. He wanted to preserve it. He wanted to keep it for himself. And so in a very ingenious way, he found a way to march his armies right into Babylon without, virtually without bloodshed and without destruction of the temple, of the entire city at all. He managed to have his engineers divert the Euphrates River, which flowed right through the city, and marched his armies right down the empty riverbed, right into the city to take it. The Persian Empire took the world in 539, and became by far and away the largest empire the world had ever known. Their border now stretched all the way from the western border and mountain range of India all the way over into Greece, what we now refer to as Greece. And so the expansion of the Persian Empire was enormous. You think of of all the nations that begin to show up on the scene. Think of Egypt first of all, down in Africa. The nation then of Assyria, and then to be followed that by Babylonia. Bigger was always better. The more territory, the more peoples you conquered, the more magnificent your empire was. Persia was the last of those great land mass controlling visions of health and wealth. The problem, of course, the larger an empire got, the harder it was to control. So there were various philosophies about how you go about controlling your land, how you go about controlling all of your conquered enemies. Assyria, the very earliest one of those three I mentioned, their philosophy was you completely destroy the culture and the identity, the people groups of those that you conquer. It was during Assyria's time that the northern tribes of Israel was taken over. So as a result, they followed their philosophy. They marched a whole lot of foreigners into Israel. They marched a whole lot of Israelites out and decimated the northern territories completely. So there really wasn't any remnant except what those that stayed behind could cling on to and hold on to and claim for themselves. And thus we come up with the name Samaritans. That's where that came from. The Syrians' desire was to just destroy any ability on the part of these neighboring conquered enemies to rise up and oppose them. Babylon, when Babylon took over Assyria, they had a different approach to controlling their borders, and that was that we centralize everything. We only take the best, the sharpest, the most capable of assets, and we bring them into the center of the nation, Babylon. And so you steal away the best, and that leaves the riffraff on the borders, and they don't have the capability of to rise up against you. You bring all of the best assets from everybody, and you bring them to the center, and you make Babylon even stronger. That was the idea. Well, that's exactly why they took Daniel and his friends and Ezekiel and all of the items from the temple. They brought it right in because they wanted not only the influence and the potential of young men like Daniel and how brilliant and bright those young men were, but they also, of course, wanted all the gold and the spiritual emphasis of this. Up until Belshazzar, the items of the Jewish temple were revered because they thought, if we bring in the God of Israel, then we've got one more God on our side. It wasn't until Belshazzar decided to party and abuse the items from the temple that God brought his judgment upon him, and that night he died, and that was when Persian army marched down the riverbed of the Euphrates right into the city of Babylon. So Babylonia then fell virtually overnight, and that left the Persian Empire, the largest in the world. Their philosophy of how to control their empire was different yet. Their idea was that, well, let's return in a benevolent exercise. Let's return these people to their countries, to their homelands. Let's make friends of them so that they will be beholden to us and that they will be faithful and loyal satellites. So in other words, if an enemy comes up and attacks us, it'll attack them first, and they'll fight on our side for us, and give us a little bit of a buffer. And so that was the idea Cyrus had when he decreed that all of you captured peoples can go home. You know, Babylon had brought all of these people toward the center of the empire, and he's sending them back home. And you can see how the ebb and the flow of all that has been of the Lord's hand as well. You know, the northern tribes of Israel were judged and judged harshly. For their entire existence as an independent nation, they had not had one king that called on the name of the Lord. Judah's record was a bit better. There were times of reform and times of glory in Judah, but they eventually fell in the same way that Israel did. But God's promise was through the line of Judah, and so he preserved Judah. In order to preserve Judah, he changed the whole world scene from Assyria to Babylonia and changed the whole philosophy. And then when the time of exile was over, God changed the world scene again, and Persia's philosophy of taking care was to send them back, and they were, and Cyrus announced to the Jews they could indeed return home. After 70 years of exile, they could return home. And that's what they did. That's what some of them did, anyway. And that's where we leave it, right? Now the Persian Empire continued to expand and to be filling the entirety of the map, going, as I said, all the way over to India, you know, in the east, and moving over into what we call Greece today, right up until the borders of a little bitty country called Macedonia. And they were knocking on the door, and they were close to taking over this little country of Macedonia, which really should have been just an appetizer on the plate. Shouldn't have been any big deal at all to take. Except for the fact that there was a feisty guy who was on the throne in Macedonia. His name was Philip. And Philip had enough loyalty to his own nation, enough gumph that he put up a fight against the massive Persian Empire. And he fought him tooth and nail until he wore himself out and he wore his nation out. And when he died, he left to his son a nation that was not only broken militarily and very, very discouraged, but also sitting on a huge stack of IOUs. His nation was terribly in debt because of all of the military fighting that they had done. And there wasn't much left. His 21-year-old son, by the way, was named Alexander. Alexander had been schooled by a man named Socrates. I'm going to mention Socrates in a little bit later, but just keep that in mind. He'd been tutored by Socrates as he grew up. And that influenced the way he thought and the way he reasoned and the way he approached the world. But we'll talk about that later. Alexander, 21-year-old, brash, nobody's going to tell a 21-year-old what to do, right? He said, "We're going to fight these guys." And he had the kind of charisma that makes young men want to pick up and follow him. And he did have a genius for military campaigns, partly because, like you might expect in a young man, he didn't like to follow the rules. And he had the most unpredictable way of fighting his battles. He would first of all study his enemy, and he would say, "Okay, in this situation, let's do this. And in that situation, let's do this." And he would not just march out his enemy and, have their little tete-a-tete and then move on. But he would study his enemy, and then he would change his approach, and sometimes change it radically. He would come across as though he were overconfident, communicating in overconfidence one time, communicating an absolute cowardice in another situation in order to make the Persian army fall for his efforts again and again and again. You probably have heard of Alexander the Great. In 11 short years, Alexander and his army of misfits moved all the way from Macedonia, up here in the top corner, swept over the entire nation of Persia into India by the time that his army finally said, "Look, we're tired, we want to go home." To this day, the military campaigns of Alexander are still studied in war colleges today. This has got to be one of the most phenomenal efforts militarily that the world has ever seen and the world has ever known. This is a mosaic. I'm sorry you can't see it very well. This is a mosaic that appears in what's something called the House of the Faun in Pompeii. Right now it's in the museum, the Naples Archaeological Museum. And it's a depiction of this classic clash between Darius of Persia and Alexandria. Over here, you see Darius, leading with all of his upturned spears and chariot wheels that are taller than men, and the machine is just surging. And as it were, providentially, you see that the mosaic chips have been destroyed or washed away for the most part to the left. But over here, right there, preserved as it were by choice, is this single figure on a horse right there. That is Alexander. And he is, he's the dark horse, the mosaic is a good picture of that, about how he is going against all odds to stir and to challenge and call his men to fight the battle. He pushes back, and after 11 years of just living by the march, never going home, never returning for anything, he and his men just kept marching. They would fight the battle, they would live there for a while, they would move further east. They never went home in 11 years. But in 11 years' time, the entirety of the Persian Empire was gone. And as it were, as you might have heard in history class, overnight, virtually overnight, the world became Greek. And that's what it means. That's where we get that term. The Greek Empire was by far and away the biggest. This put Persia to shame. So now you've got this growing empire concept in the minds and hearts of those that are conquering. Here's this brash 32-year-old, and he's got the biggest empire the world has ever known. But his army came up short, and they said, "Look, it's been 11 years. We want to go home. We didn't sign up to take over the world. We just signed up to bloody their nose and leave us alone. And we want to go home." And finally, they created such a mutiny that he had to give in. But by this time, his lust for this kind of warfare had consumed him. And all he could think of was fighting and living on the edge and all of the, of course, all of the human weaknesses that fall along with supporting that. His response to their decision to stop fighting and return home was to die. At a time when he should have been starting his life, his partying, his hard life, his passion, his lust for power and warfare, whatever it was, consumed him, and he did not last very long at all. Whether there was a medical condition or whether it was something having to do with his liver's condition after the consumption of mass quantities of alcohol, who knows? We don't know for sure. Exactly what it was, but all we know is that after this young man had taken over the world stage, he died. And when his generals, five in number, came to him on his deathbed and asked him, "Who are you leaving your kingdom to?" I mean, this is enormous. You know, this is the world's greatest empire. No one has ever seen anything like this before. Is who are you leaving this to? In typical fashion, Alexander simply said, "To the strongest." Well, that's not what he got. He had five follower generals, none of whom were very strong. And so their decision was to divide the empire of Alexander into five different areas. And before long, three of those were absorbed by the jealousy and the conniving and the backstabbing of the more prominent ones. And so soon after this all happened, you had the establishment of two major empires that were remnants of Alexander's. The north and the east was called the Seleucids, after the commander Seleucus. They occupied the majority of the vast part up there. It looks like they, by far and away, take more land than what Ptolemy is left with to the south. But you have to understand how precious Egypt and the land bridge there are, and the whole area of Canaan, and how significant that is. That it's not surprising at all that this is where the borders fell. Ptolemy governed to the south. Ptolemy governed Egypt, Mediterranean coastline, over across the Sinaitic land bridge at the peninsula and up into Canaan, controlling almost all the way up to Antioch. And that's kind of how things stayed for a while. Now, that's all about the first point that we talked about. Let me talk now about the second point. By this time, you know, my first point is that the world is exploding and changing and becoming very, very different than it was when we closed the Old Testament. One of the things that's not really understood very well among Christians is how amazingly influential and early the spread of the Jewish people were to all of this region that is now changing. We sometimes refer to the Jewish diaspora, meaning the scattering of the Jews at the time of the fall of Israel in 722, those that ran away from the attack of Babylon in 586, but it was actually happening much earlier than that. And the Jews who were doing this traveling were leaving in some very noticeably predictable ways. They would drift off. I always have to reverse myself. They always drift. Some would drift off into what we refer to as Asia Minor, and on into Greece, and even deep into Macedonia. While others would go south into Egypt, follow the Nile, even deep into Egypt, even into Ethiopia. Others would be spreading out into various places, and wherever they went, they took the Word of God and the understanding of the one true God as opposed to idols, and a world and life view that was radically different than anything else the world had ever known. I mentioned at the very beginning of the hour that history itself, being linear, was a radically different concept than anything. Time was only measured by the length of a king's rule in the West. In the East, time was considered cyclical. And the idea that there was purpose for time, that there was purpose for history, was an influence of the world and life view the Jews were spreading into the world. And this was aided by the fact that the Jews, wherever they went, were very influential in what they did. They were good at the various arts and sciences. They were good at agriculture. They were good at business. They were good at making the most of what opportunities they had. And that, again, is world and life view aspect to it. Not that the other cultures were completely absent of this, but it's the Jews who had the creation mandate, that the world is there for you to develop and to work hard and to produce something from it, to the glory of God. And so the industry that pervaded that, the idea of discovery and development of what the world had to offer, was part of the contribution, the very early contribution, that in itself did have influence. Might be debatable how much, but I'm persuaded it's quite a bit. Did have influence, for instance, in the development of philosophy. The idea and reflection of who it is I am. What is the world? What is truth? The wrestlings of those things. And as the influence of the Jews and their world and life view were spread, the pagan world and the various cultures would accept what they liked and drew from it and built on it. And so I don't think that it's any mistake that the time of the explosion of these empires happened at the same time the Jews themselves were scattering and spreading. Now, at the time when Babylon, you know, swept over and took over Jerusalem and the temple fell and was burned, that was preempted, first of all, by the northern tribe had already fallen, and those that saw that coming, they are the ones that fled to Asia Minor. But now Babylon, with Babylon coming, there were many in Jerusalem that saw that, and they fled south and into Egypt, and carried with them Jeremiah, for one thing, we know of for sure. But then those that were exiled, the best and the brightest, you remember, were taken to Babylon. Daniel was one of them, and Ezekiel, and several others that we only know of by by one or two stories or nothing else. But their influence was phenomenal. And we see that in the study of Daniel when we read how influential he was, how long he served. He came to Babylon when he was about 13 years old. He died when he was about 80. All of that time he was in the service of the court. He survived three different nations ruling over him. And at the time, he was recognized for his reputability and for his contribution, and his influence, therefore, was eagerly welcomed. And so also, of course, we can conclude from that many of the Jews in the area also made powerful contributions to what was going on in Babylon at the time. So much so that when Cyrus of Persia released the Jews and said, "You can go back home," a great many of the eager ones wanted to do that, but there were just as many who said, "No, I want to stay here." Now you might say, "Well, you know, maybe they were, you know, they just settled in, they just consumed, you know, this is home now. I don't remember Jerusalem." There were also some that had a reason for doing that, and one of them was that there was a school of study that had established itself in Babylon. The Babylonian school of the Talmud had begun during this time, as well as the development of the synagogue emerged from this time. The weekly study of the Word of God developed, and there was a great cache of Jewish and Jewish scholars who decided to stay in Babylon to continue to develop their theology and continue to develop their thought, and their influence in the world continued to grow. But the ones who came to Jerusalem, they were the ones who were heart passionate for home. And they came, over the hillside and viewed the destruction of Jerusalem was now 70 years old. You know, there's nothing left but the stones and the grass and the wild animals and the tents and the hovels of those that had been left behind. And they immediately begin their work of rebuilding. These are the ones who have a couple of things in mind. Number one is they have a vision for building, restoring again the glory of Jerusalem. They want this more than anything else. All they can think of is what their fathers had told them, what they read in the Jewish scriptures about what it was like for King David and King Solomon and all of the glory days of the past, and they're burdened for this. And of course, they want the temple. The temple had been destroyed now, and they wanted it rebuilt. And it was the magnificent edifice of the center of their life as well as their religion, and that was the passion of their heart to rebuild that. But the symbol of the temple also symbolized the need for preserving the past, and that was a big part of the mentality of those that went back, is we have to preserve the past. And that essence of we have to preserve the past is being pressured by this first point, that the world is drastically changing. And there's the change of mindset for the Jews that come to Jerusalem is we want to preserve this, we want to protect it, we don't want it evaporating away. So you've got two different kinds of Jewish mentalities going on. You know, the Jews that went to Asia Minor, the Jews that went to Africa, they're very productive, they're very involved, they influence their world, things are moving because of their influence. You've got the school in Babylon, which is very strong and very solid and very reputable, and it's having its influence. And the Jews here in Jerusalem, they have a whole different mindset. Now, they want to preserve and protect what used to be. We want the good old days of David back, and they're very passionate about this. And as this time continues to develop, they even begin to kick around a name for the threat that they see. They didn't invent this to my knowledge, but it's a word that they use very eagerly, and that is Hellenism. Maybe you've heard that word before. Hellenism. Hellenism is simply, depending on who defines it for you, it means Greek culture, Greek way of life, Greek world and life view. To the Jews in Jerusalem, Hellenism meant worldliness, humanistic thinking, the influence of the world that is unwelcome here. And so as stronger Hellenism became, the more threat that was to the Jews that were in Jerusalem, and the more concerned they became for that. Lifestyle of the world around them was becoming more and more popular. More and more things were happening that more and more people were getting into. They had exciting lives. Culture was developing societies and cities and attitudes of life that were very, very different. And this began to show itself on Jewish families in Jerusalem and Jewish teenagers in Jerusalem. They would see their non-Jewish friends. They would see them having all this fun. They would see them giving themselves to idleness and to preoccupations and to temptations. And they were encouraged to do so by their culture. And nobody saw anything wrong. And they were enjoying themselves as well they might. Greek mythology, which was permeating this entire culture, was also holding up these heroes and heroines that were divine in nature. And yet you look at them closely, you see that most of them, except for, of course, the authority figures of the ultimate thing, most of them are absolute perfections in terms of the forms of their bodies. The men are masculine and powerful, and the women are lovely and seductive. And of course, they're dressed in the nude. And these gods and goddesses that are held up as heroes and heroines in Greek culture, they have divinely large appetites for war and for sex and for deceit and for corruption. And these are the things that were, that you see, when man invents gods and goddesses, it is for the purpose of inspiring and justifying the directions that you want to go in. And that's exactly what this was. Greek mythology is all about holding up and glorifying the things that we want to do also in our lives that are pushing the taboos of society. And Jewish kids were looking at this and they were saying, this is rubbing off on, the Jewish parents were worried, this is rubbing off on them, they want to participate in this. They see their friends running the races. The Olympics, of course, is the big one, but they would have weekly and monthly contests and the boys would run in the nude. And of course, the women were there, the girls were there. There wasn't anything, they weren't above this sort of thing. It was all on purpose. And the Jewish boys wanted to participate. They wanted everything, but they were circumcised and they were mocked and they were laughed at. And there were even some who experimented with reverse circumcision so they would look like everybody else. And Jewish parents were becoming very concerned about the influence of Hellenism because it was permeating everything. And how hard it was for them to hold on to that which would declared their past, they began to be very protective and very defensive and very introverted about their religion and their faith and their culture and their society, and they became they chose to refuse everything that was going on. But they still had a choice to do that. They weren't, society wasn't yet coercing them to do anything more. And so it was still a free world, although the pressures, societal pressures and everything else was building up. But then the world stage changed once again.
changed once again.
The Ptolemies to the south lost control of the land bridge, and the Seleucids to the north moved in. And now you had a different governing structure, and now Hellenism changed from being an option to a mandate. The Ptolemies tolerated the Jews. Seleucids weren't in a mind to do that. And so now Hellenism was required. They were forced to accept an attitude of toleration. Sound familiar? You will accept what we accept. You will not oppose what we think is fine. And it became mandatory. The synagogues of those who tried to hold out were burned to the ground. Torahs that were found were torched. Rabbis were silenced one way or the other. Their children were forced now to comply. Circumcision was illegal. They will become Hellenized. Directions that the sinful man takes to assert himself are very predictable, brothers and sisters. Things go from being enticements to options to mandatory requirements very quickly. And it is something to keep in mind when we see our own world and we ask ourselves, well, why not? What's wrong with it? I don't see anything wrong with it. It won't be long before that turns on us. And to rebel against our God will be required. And you will have a choice. Your children will have a choice. And it will be for life or death. When the Jews continued to object, things got violent. Seleucids simply sent in their army and would beat up a bunch and murder some and then leave until the next insurrection came. We're going to leave it there. That doesn't finish our intertestamental period, but we're going to leave it there. There are these two things. Overnight, the world became Greek, probably at a significant influence that was given them by God through His Word, through the written word of the Lord, and the change in the world and life view that brought a drastic change to the world. But the world did not want the giver. The world just wanted the gift. And it demonstrated that by taking the benefits, by taking the blessings, by taking the good things that God's gift had to offer, but then turning around and rejecting the giver for it. And in this result, you see, it is a common aspect to man that the dark always detests the light. Man in his sinfulness will take whatever he likes, whatever benefits, whatever gifts, but to say, bow down to the giver, and said, no, we will crucify him. We will have nothing to do with him. We will destroy him. And this is the stage that we see developing, where the world is benefiting hand over fist by the influence of God's gift of His Word, His revelation. And yet, at the same time, they are rejecting the very God that is the giver. Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you very much that we can study this. I pray, Lord, that I might not move too fast, but that might be truly a benefit for everyone, especially those who have never even heard of some of these things before. Lord, make us students of history so that we may see your hand moving in it. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.